Minimum Wage Guarantees for Disabled Workers, a report from the Department of Justice by Eve L. Hill. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Eve L. Hill. From the editor, Eve Hill is well known to those who attend the convention or read accounts of it in this magazine. She has worked for the law firm of Brown, Goldstein & Levy, as the director of the Office for Disability Rights for the District of Columbia, as the senior vice president for the Burton Blatt Institute, and now for the United States Department of Justice. One of the reasons she is a regular fixture on our convention agenda is that she always has something of interest to say. Here's what she said on the morning of July 6, 2014.
I'm so happy to be here back at the National Federation of the Blind. Thank you for having me. It's a little intimidating seeing you all out here, but I'm going to try and be calm. So, on February 12, 2014, President Obama issued Executive Order 13658, establishing a minimum wage for contractors. And the executive order generally raises the minimum wage for certain federal service contractors and subcontractors to $10.10 an hour beginning January 1, 2015. The purpose of the executive order is to increase morale of employees and, in turn, increase their productivity and efficiency. And whose pay and morale is likely to be most increased by this? People who are blind and have other disabilities, because their pay is now lower than anyone else's. So what does the executive order mean to people with disabilities? The executive order specifically says that covered federal contractors who have special minimum wage certificates under Section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act must comply with the executive order. Now, as you all know, Section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act allows employers to pay wages below the prevailing wage and below the minimum wage to workers with disabilities. Section 14C can be used by federal contractor employers and non-federal contractor employers. And many of the employers who take advantage of Section 14C are segregated, sheltered workshops. And about 20% of them are federal contractors who participate in the Ability One program, which gives them a contracting preference for if their worker population in their workforce is 75% people with disabilities. So not only are they relatively segregated, but they also get the benefit of paying below minimum wage. And Ability One employer is approved and its services are placed on the procurement list, that contract is often renewed automatically. The executive order does not change the Fair Labor Standards Act itself, because that would require legislation. So these Ability One employers can still pay workers with disabilities a percentage of the prevailing wage, which is usually for service contracts set by the Service Contracts Act. And the Department of Labor sets those rates. They're mostly higher than the federal minimum wage and often already higher than 1010. But because of the interplay of 14C, those contractors have until now been able to pay below 1010 and even below the minimum wage. But under the executive order, employers under new covered service contracts, including Ability One employers, must pay their workers, including workers with disabilities, at least 1010. 1010 becomes the floor. So about 50,000 people with disabilities under Ability One contracts currently make below the minimum wage. Most of those, however, work on products contracts, which aren't covered by the executive order. So according to the Office of Management and Budget, the vast majority of people with disabilities working on these contracts, working on service contracts, already make 1010 an hour. But if it applied to current contracts now, the executive order would apply to thousands of people with disabilities who are currently working on Ability One service contracts and currently making less than 1010 an hour and even less than minimum wage. The executive order only applies to service contracts by executive agencies, not independent agency, but it strongly encourages independent agencies to comply as well. And it only applies to new contracts. It doesn't apply to contracts being applied outside the U.S., and it doesn't apply to federal grants. So what's happening now? The executive order requires the Department of Labor to issue regulations by October of this year. And on June 17th, the Department of Labor published a notice of proposed rulemaking to implement the executive order. Comments from all of you, and the rest of the public, are due by July 17th. Now, I can't say much about the rulemaking because not my rulemaking, and because the process has started, so I'm not allowed to give a lot of information beyond what's in the notice of proposed rulemaking. And I understand that Pat Hsu spoke about this from the Department of Labor already. I'm a little afraid that because of that limitation, my presentation may be a little boring. So if I start to get interesting, I've gone off script. So the NPRM would define a new contract covered by the executive order as one that results from a solicitation issued after January 1, 2015, or a contract that is awarded outside the solicitation process on or after January 5, 2015. This includes new contracts and replacements for expiring contracts. And under the NPRM, the executive order would not apply to automatic renewals of contracts that were issued before January 2015. I'm going to skip through the boring part. Even the part I know is boring. But what Dr. Maurer really asked me to talk about was how this fit and how this represents an evolution in federal policy. Both Section 14C and the Ability One program came from statutes originally enacted in 1938. How many of us were around in 1938? Well, you may recall that these statutes were well before the enactment of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, or the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. They were before reasonable accommodations were required by public and private employers. They were before Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act required affirmative action by federal contractors to hire and retain people with disabilities. They were before the development and widespread implementation of supported employment services and supports. At the time of those statutes, people with disabilities were largely presumed unable to work in integrated competitive employment. And at that time, people with disabilities were assumed to have access to charity and public benefits sufficient to meet their needs, so why did they need wages? All I clearly disagree with now. But much of that has changed. The ADA now prohibits employers from discriminating against applicants on the basis of their disability, and requires them to provide reasonable accommodations. Section 503 now requires affirmative action to hire and retain people with disabilities. Supported employment services have been recognized in the Developmental Disability Assistance and Bill of Rights Act of 1984 and are now widely available. And people with disabilities have consistently demonstrated that we are capable of working in integrated competitive employment. People with disabilities are unwilling to rely on charity and public benefits, but insist on making real living and contributing to their families and communities. So the executive order is recognizing that people with disabilities work hard and that they need and deserve the same living wage as people without disabilities. As I often say, we are not leprechauns. We do not have a pot of gold. If you can't live on less than 10.10 an hour, neither can we. And people with disabilities, that was a little off script, sorry. And people with disabilities, like other employees, will improve their morale and their efficiency and productivity when they are paid fairly. The executive order is consistent with and builds on other federal policies that recognize that people with disabilities are capable of competitive, integrated employment and are entitled to be free of discrimination, to be accommodated, and to be fairly paid for their work. This is not the beginning of this federal recognition. It's been coming. In 2001, the Federal Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program eliminated permanent placement in sheltered workshops, or so-called extended employment, in the agency's lingo, from the list of services it will fund. The Rehabilitation Services Administration remains committed to supported employment in competitive integrated settings as an effective service for clients of state VR programs. The agency's regulations, thanks. Thank you to them. The agency's regulations, I think some of you all here had a hand in that. The agency's regulations define supported employment for people with disabilities to mean competitive employment in an integrated setting or employment in integrated work settings in which individuals are working toward competitive employment consistent with their strengths, resources, priorities, concerns, abilities, capabilities, interests, and informed choice. Similarly, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, referred to as CMS, which oversees the Medicaid program and that which provides long-term services and supports, has embraced supported employment services and declared that pre-vocational services provided in sheltered workshop settings should be time-limited and designed to lead to integrated employment. They cannot be services without placement. They've said, their informational bulletin in 2001 said that Medicaid community services funding is not available for the provision of vocational services delivered in facility-based or sheltered workshop settings where individuals are supervised for the primary purpose of producing goods or performing services. Those services should be designed to create a path to integrated community employment where the individual is compensated at or above the minimum wage and no less than a customary wage and level of benefits paid for similar work by individuals without disabilities. The Department of Education has also recognized the importance of supplementary aids and services, including supported employment, as part of in-school transition services for youth to enable students to work in integrated settings, both while they're in school and after they're in school, and it defines transition services to include supported employment. Even Congress is getting on the bad bandwagon and considering restricting eligibility for subminimum wage work through the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. I'm sure that Dr. Maurer thought when he asked me to speak about subminimum wage that that would stop me from talking about all the great things DOJ is doing, but ha, it will not. This work also has a significant overlap with the Justice Department Civil Rights Division's efforts in implementing the ADA's integration mandate, the Olmstead mandate, as we call it, in the employment arena. Because many of the entities that employ people below minimum wage under 14C are segregated, sheltered workshops. Olmstead requires that state services be provided in the most integrated setting appropriate for the individual, and that includes not just residential services, not just healthcare services, but employment services as well. So we recently reached a statewide settlement with Rhode Island to transform its day services program from one that relied primarily on segregated subminimum wage sheltered workshops and segregated day programs to one that will rely on integrated, competitive, supported employment and integrated day services. And we're also in litigation on the same issues in Oregon. Now we have the additional benefit of Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act. So we've been talking about the push end, where we push people to get the services that people with disabilities need, and now we're on the pull side, where we want employers pulling to hire people with disabilities. Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act has new regulations that require federal contractors to implement affirmative action programs to get over past discrimination, to hire people with disabilities, including a utilization goal in all job classifications to have 7% of their employees be people with disabilities. These regulations also require data collection so contractors can keep track of how well they're doing. And we all know that what gets counted gets done. And I personally, I'm a little tired, but I'm personally involved in 3 interagency groups that are working on increasing the integrated competitive employment of people with disabilities, and particularly people with significant disabilities, who should not be left out of this. Like the executive order itself, these changes in federal policy are not just about justice. Wouldn't it be nice that that's all we needed? They're about the bottom line for business and for the country and for people with disabilities. And we are already seeing results on those bottom lines. Employers are looking for people with disabilities. Employers who've already been committed to inclusion are benefiting. At a summit I was at just a week and a half ago on employment of people with disabilities in Rhode Island, large, medium, and small businesses all made clear that they believed their employees with disabilities contributed positively to their workplaces, not just through their productivity and doing a good job, but also through their reliability, their positive morale. Many of these employers became a no-whining zone, and even their accommodations, which often made the workplace more safe and efficient for everybody. As a result, from employers, large, small, and medium, we heard over and over again their commitment to the same jobs, the same standards, and the same pay for their employees with disabilities. Even businesses are starting to notice that they've been contracting with sheltered workshops to do some of their work, sometimes as part of what they thought was a good thing, their diversity in contracting programs. And then they shockingly found that those workshops were paying below the minimum wage to people with disabilities who can work and should be paid. So some of them are now considering demanding that all their contractors and subcontractors pay at least the minimum wage. And some are hiring people with disabilities out of the workshops that they used to contract out to do the jobs in-house at regular wages. From a societal standpoint, federal policy focusing on competitive integrated employment is also paying off. The studies keep showing that supported employment services offer a great return on investment. Supported employment services return an average of $1.46 for every dollar in taxpayer investment. People with learning disabilities return as much as $2.20 for every dollar. That's a fantastic return on investment. Think about whether you invested in the stock market at that rate. And that's not counting the benefit to the workers with disabilities themselves, who make a great deal of money more in competitive integrated employment than in sheltered workshops. That's buying power that they and their families can use to buy products and services from companies that hire people with disabilities. But that benefit is more than money. Even though money is important, I like it. I have met several people in Rhode Island who used to work in a sheltered workshop over the course of the past year and who now work in competitive integrated jobs. I've seen them each several times over the past year, and every time I've seen them, they've changed. One man, Stephen, who worked for about $2 an hour for 30 years, now works for minimum wage in an office and is taking computer classes. Wow. Just as importantly, he has come out of his shell and is a passionate, funny speaker talking about employment of people with disabilities. And Pedro, who went straight from a school-based sheltered workshop, who knew this was still happening, to an adult sheltered workshop and earned 48 cents an hour. Now he works in a restaurant kitchen, was recently chosen as Employee of the Month. He doesn't use a job coach anymore. And in fact, he teaches his former job coach how to teach others. Lewis used to make below minimum wage in the workshop. Now he works full-time in an office for more than minimum wage. He is a whiz at Excel. He drives to work every day, having gotten his license. He wears a necktie, which he hates, and he has decorated his office with Red Sox paraphernalia. He's a big fan. And I'm a Mainer, so I'm with him. Sorry, Broncos, Seahawks. Different sport, but seriously, all Boston. And when the Red Sox won the World Series, he bought his father and his uncle, also avid fans, championship t-shirts with his own money. Since Peter left the workshop, he has a full-time job doing janitorial work. Not a group of people with disabilities doing janitorial work after the office has closed. He does it as part of a group of people without disabilities. He makes above minimum wage, full-time, bought a car, took driving lessons, got his first parking ticket the last time I saw him, which he can pay, and has gotten engaged. Orcadio, who goes by Q for obvious reasons. He made $2.85 an hour in the workshop, now works in an auto garage. His work and his accommodation showed his boss how to make the garage more efficient for everybody who works there. He takes two buses to work every day. He is always the first to arrive. He arrives in snowstorms when nobody else makes it in. I saw him at the summit I was talking about a week or so ago, and when we first saw him in the workshop, he was very shy and didn't want to talk to us. Then the next time I saw him when he was working in the garage, he would say a little bit to me, a couple sentences to me about rotating tires on a car, because I've always wanted to know how to do that. And then the next time, last week at the summit, he spoke on a panel in front of 250 people. And I swear he's gotten taller. So, why with all this good news on the how much this benefits society, how much it benefits the employers, how much it benefits people with disabilities, why are over 200,000 people with disabilities still in sheltered workshops and 200,000 more in segregated day programs not working at all? Why are people with disabilities still making minimum wage? You don't know either. What we do, why do we as a community still tolerate segregation and poverty based on disability, just on disability? Don't know the answer to that one. Why are the unemployment rates still so high for people with disabilities? Three times as high as for people without disabilities. Two times as high even if you're a college graduate. Are we less competent? No. Are we less confident?
No.
Thank you. Do we have low expectations of ourselves?
No. No.
Are we afraid of hard work?
No.
But do we have low expectations of employers, businesses? I'm afraid we may. Do we have low expectations of government?
Yes.
Do we have low expectations of service providers?
Yes.
Maybe. But we're at a tipping point. We can accept the argument that we'll be the last ones hired as the economy continues to recover. We can accept that we'll be paid less because we're lucky to be working at all. We can accept charity and poverty because they're safe. Or we can stand up and insist on high expectations for ourselves, for our employers, for the businesses we buy from, and from our government. And they will respond. Thank you all very much.